sometimes people like to say things off the book.
I doubt I'll be.
Yeah, and people don't say either, usually, in case this ever got lost.
Oh, really?
Yeah, right. Just, you know, you might say something about your mother or your aunt.
And, right, that's not appreciated.
Right.
Okay.
So, did your international, you originally were born?
In Belgium, yep. Ghent, which is between Antwerp and Brussels in Belgium. Did it impact kind of the way I view, it impacts the way I view city living, I guess?
Sure,
and
yeah.
Impacts, mostly transportation, like transportation is a huge difference. That to me is always the biggest difference in when I come to a city like Syracuse or even Philly, you know, even the bigger cities that still have pretty minimal transportation systems in terms of like a railway or a subway and things like that.
Compared to your experience there.
Yeah, compared to, you know, every city in Belgium, even if they don't have, you know, most of them might not have a subway system, but they have such an efficient rail system that the trains can get you anywhere near to where you need to be, and it's not such a hassle. Like, you know, say you live in, like, I think a major barrier for Syracuse is that folks, say, that live in, I don't know, DeWitt, and they just consider going to the city such a hassle because they're like, oh, I got to deal with parking, I got to, you know, it's going to take me whatever 25 minutes to get there, and it's just to go for like a bite to eat. So they're like, let's just find a restaurant and do it. But that same scenario in Belgium, or other, you know, other places in Europe that I visited, it was different because it was so easy to hop on the train. It was never more than like, you know, 50 to 100 yards from your house, some sort of station. That with trains that go all night long, they don't like cut off, so you're not worried that you're gonna get stuck downtown at 11:30 at night, and so you're more inclined to take advantage of like kind of the cultural things going on in the city. So I've kind of noticed that being in a barrier, and then also, you know, so that's more maybe on the higher income level barrier, you know, to access of stuff, but on the lower income level, in terms of folks that just can't afford cars here, you know, we have people here that come to the center that want to, you know, say they want to come for our GED program or for the tax program or whatever, and they hear about us. Or we have kids that are trying to get to school, and they're showing up to school consistently 45 minutes late or whatever, they're missing the bus, and then they show up 2 hours late because the bus is so infrequent and there's a major stop. Everything goes through downtown before you can go somewhere else. So, you know, it's just such a barrier to low-income folks. And then I think people in the social services get fed up with them, kind of being like, why can't you make an appointment on time? You know, why can't you be here? When realistically it's because of a poor public transportation. And I just didn't experience that as much in, you know, in the cities that I lived in Belgium, in Brussels or in Antwerp. It was always much more just accessible to everybody. Maybe the bus system wasn't as strong, but again, the rail system is just phenomenal. So,
great.
Yeah.
So what led you to come to the U.S.?
My parents. The reason I was, the first time, or both times, is my dad works for Wyeth Pharmaceuticals, one of the major pharmaceutical companies. But so as he kept getting promoted to different things, it was, you know, first promoted to then move to the U.S. and then we moved back to Belgium when I was 10 for this, because he was then general manager of it was called like the Benelux area, so Belgium, Holland, and Luxembourg. And then we moved back again because of his job to Philadelphia, is where I spent my high school career, I guess. And then so yeah. So then that's how I got to the U.S. And then to getting to Syracuse was, ended up going to college at University of Delaware, where I got an undergrad in psych and sociology, and then went to, did a little bit of case management stuff for like 6 months, and kind of said, all right, I want to go back and get my master's in social work, with the idea of becoming a clinical social worker. I didn't plan on doing community development. I always kind of was like, I just want to do, while doing case management, I saw folks that were doing clinical work, and I talked to them what degrees they had. They had masters in social work, so I was like, okay, that's my next kind of logical step. So I moved to Baltimore, to go to University of Maryland's program there, and they have a really good strong program, I guess, compared to some others. But pretty much as soon as I got there, you're required to take, if you were in the clinical track, you're also required to take one community class in that first semester. And I immediately hated all my clinical classes and loved the community class, just because it became so apparent. And simultaneously, I was doing an internship as part of my studies at a middle school doing clinical social work. At an inner city middle school that was just a total mess in Baltimore. I mean, Baltimore educational system is... People complain about Syracuse City's educational system, but it's amazing compared to Baltimore's. But I realize that so many of the issues, you know, it's kind of the way I was just talking about transportation, and you blame folks for saying, why can't you make an appointment on time? But there's all these other systemic problems. And that's kind of what I realized was happening in this middle school and kind of all over, where instead of doing clinical social work to kind of look at the one isolated problem they were dealing with at the time, I was much more interested in saying, like, holistically, what are your barriers to, like, moving to improving, you know, your quality of life, and I saw the way to kind of facilitate that holistic approach was through community development. So they, fortunately, University of Maryland is, I think, one of 10 or 20 programs in the country for masters in social work that have a, it was called community development and social action major. So I kind of switched out right away, and kind of moved toward the community development and kind of more grassroots community organizing kind of stuff.
What made you interested in social work and, you know, in general, and first?
That's a good question. I think I grew up in a wealthy, you know, family. Mm-hmm. So I think initially, I think when I was like 14 or 15, you know, my parents were always big on taking us to a lot of cultural experiences and things like that, and we didn't do, like, the vacations to, I don't know, like a sandy beach or something, but more like into cities and looking at whatever cultural stuff. And so I think I was exposed to a decent amount of poverty and kind of talking, experiencing that and kind of wrestling with, you know, that's, there's this whole other society that lives that way and I don't. So I think initially it was kind of based on guilt, you know, kind of saying like, man, how can I live in the suburbs and experience, you know, quality education and go to college and not even think about it, you know, and have my parents buy me a car or whatever. While there's other kids, you know, that don't have a book bag and pencils and stuff like that. And so it kind of started with that. And simultaneously, I got much more interested in my faith. And, you know, the more that I kind of started going back to church and going back to, you know, reading my Bible and things like that, just realizing that serving the poor is by far the most number one talked about topic in the Bible in a lot of ways. You know, if you look, if you were to cross-reference words in there, the poor comes up a whole lot. And so, you know, kind of those combined things, I kind of want to say, well, what can I do? And so that's how I kind of got into social work. And then through that course, I kind of just got to community development.
Great. And in the process somewhere, you got hooked on art?
Yeah. I got hooked on art. Man, when did I? You know, it was my... this is random, but I have my cousin in Belgium, when I was living there, he was trying to figure out what to do with his life. And I don't think he'd ever picked up a pencil or, you know, or any sort of artistic medium. And one day we were kind of sitting and we were bored at my grandparents' house. And he said, all right, I'm going to try and draw you. And I was like, all right, whatever. And out of nowhere came this amazing piece of art. You know, and it was kind of the first time that maybe because it naturally engaged me, because it was kind of like this surreal kind of portrait of me, I was like, oh, this is kind of cool, you know. And then also with my parents always taking us to museums and stuff, I was kind of always interested in it. But then kind of seeing an artist actually create something was when I was really interested in it. And mm-hmm. and my cousin I'd always kind of looked up to for a long time. So anyway, he ended up going on and becoming doing a lot of performance art in Belgium, and is now that's kind of his full-time gig. So I kind of always kind of followed his career and was really interested in that, and seeing him become successful, and it just intrigued me. And so there's that, and then also my man, I'm talking a lot about my family vacations, but a lot on when we go on these trips, my dad was like obsessed with taking pictures. Mm-hmm. So he would take tons and tons of family pictures and pictures of whatever, you know, think buildings and flowers, and they're always pretty good. And so I think I just kind of picked up one of his old cameras, you know, that was just sitting there, and so I started getting interested in photography and goofing around a little bit with the camera and seeing what I could do. And I think at that time, internet was kind of taking off, and so you could kind of start researching what people were doing and different tricks you could do with cameras and stuff. So I kind of was into that. So I started messing around with, you know, 35 millimeter film, and it was fun. And I took a summer class at University of Delaware in undergrad in photography, and that's kind of when I learned how to develop film and really, I think, kind of got a taste for it in my mouth, I guess. And my professor at the time was really, she was only, I don't know, maybe, you know, she was young, just a couple years older than us, the students. And I would end up kind of just going back to her and spending hours kind of in the dark room talking with her of what I could do to improve my pictures and looking at different things and not just taking, you know, a static image of somebody's face, but trying to have movement in there and things like that. And so she, I would kind of attribute my, you know, my dad's interest in photography and then her urging me to get into the realm of digital photography, you know, because I was ready to buy a darkroom kind of kit. And she said, you know, I think this is when, like, the highest megapixel was still, like, 3.2 or something like that. And she's like, you know, digital cameras are starting to take off. You should just get that, and you can do it all on your computer and stuff. And so that's kind of when I really got into it, when it when I wasn't paying for developing film or anything anymore, and it was just like taking hundreds of pictures, and it didn't matter. And that's when I kind of started to hone my skills, I guess, and just read about it and kept taking pictures and more pictures and learning more. So that's kind of how I got into photography. And then through photography, I just kind of got into doing graphic design a little bit on the side. That kind of just came naturally, as putting text over images and then doing lots of filters and learning more about what Photoshop had to offer. It kind of all just started coming into play. And I, you know, had a bunch of friends who were into graphic design and things like that. So we built a little just community of people that were always talking about it, you know, and going to see events.
Was this in Philadelphia? Or
That's still at University of Delaware.
So, okay, so this is still during undergrad.
Yeah, this is still during undergrad, but that's kind of the end of my undergrad, and that when I was really getting into it. And then I moved to Baltimore. And that's when, I think in Baltimore was when I got the real taste for public arts and for using arts as not just a means of expressing yourself, but showing issues and, you know, using it as kind of like a social justice tool. Yeah, that was really in Baltimore. I mean, it coincided with what I was doing with my social work program, but then also they have this great museum in Baltimore, and I'm not going to be able to think of what it is. I think the American Visionary Art Museum, maybe? Yeah, AVAM, yep. And it's a museum dedicated to artists who have no formal training. So to get your stuff shown there, you cannot have any formal training. And it's this funky building. They have a huge sculpture garden, and all amazing work. And most of that work, I noticed that folks that were untrained in art seemed to have this greater, it's like they were more inclined to use art as their medium of expressing themselves, and not just for the sake of expressing their interest in art or, you know, what they're making, but really expressing their political views, their social views. And so I was really into that museum, and at the same time, there are galleries popping up in Baltimore, kind of relevant to that stuff, and also just seeing a lot of public art kind of start to pop up. Mm-hmm. So I just started reading about it and seeing that it can really be a tool for social action, I guess. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a sculptor or, you know, anything like that. So I think my... I was always appreciative of it, but outside of it, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, I continued in Baltimore to do a lot of photography. That's when I kind of started to sell some of my work and have it exhibited a little bit and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But I was just starting to get into public art, but only as a viewer, which I guess takes me to Syracuse. Mm-hmm. So I moved up to Syracuse.
Why? Syracuse?
Yeah.
from Baltimore.
From Baltimore, yep. I was in Baltimore, and my best friend, who went to Syracuse University that I went to high school with, he was getting married, and I was his best man, and that's where I met my now wife, was at the wedding. She was up at Syracuse. She's born and raised here. I was at Syracuse University at the time. We started dating long distance for a while, and then... she got a job working at Holy Cross Church mm-hmm. and here in DeWitt. And so it didn't make sense, since I was just starting to look for a job, that I would make, you know, and since she had a good job that she really liked, it didn't make sense for her to move to Baltimore versus me move up here, mm-hmm. while at the time mm-hmm. I was not particularly impressed with Syracuse. I said, okay, yeah, let's move here, we'll be together. And then eventually we'll move somewhere else. Mm-hmm. But once I got here, I really liked it. So I got here, we were dating at the time, I moved into an apartment up on Park Street, and she was living with her parents at the time. And I moved next to Dominic. Mm-hmm.
You didn't know him.
So I didn't know him.
He was just a neighbor.
Mm-hmm. I happened to move directly next to his apartment, and I was watching World Cup. it was the summer when the World Cup was going on, and my door was wide open, and he just happened to knock, and he had just stopped at Middle Ages Brewery, which is right next to our apartment. Okay. And he brought over a couple bottles of beer, mm-hmm. and we ended up watching soccer, and... he kind of started to notice when he looked around in my living room, I guess, started to notice a lot of books that he had kind of read or was interested in. He noticed a lot of music that was similar, and he saw some of my photography, and, mm-hmm. You know, we had the same subscriptions to magazines kind of mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. And so we kind of just really became good friends pretty quickly based on this interest in community development, mm-hmm. our interest in music, and our interest in art. Mm-hmm. And... as our friendship progressed, he was able to get this job here at the mm-hmm. ECC Center, and we had kind of talked about these things.
So he was still
he was a coach. Yeah, he was coaching football at the time, mm-hmm. and I was working at Center for Community Alternatives downtown, mm-hmm. working. So I was actually doing clinical work, which is not what I wanted to mm-hmm. do, but you know, I was just dedicated to moving up here more than anything else, mm-hmm. and so I said, well, let's. I'll just take any job I can get. Because mm-hmm. If you search for community development stuff, it's tough to know what exists in a city until you're living in the city. Mm. And so I kind of just took the job, and I paid the bills, and I didn't mind doing it. Mm-hmm. It was fine. But then, you know, Dominic and I would kind of talk at night about creating a community center or having... you know, doing this kind of economic and community mm-hmm. development mm-hmm. work mm-hmm. somewhere. Uh-huh. You know, we didn't know that much about the North Side at the time. But then he got involved here through Father Canise, who kind of became his mentor. Mm-hmm. And he eventually offered Dominic a job in doing just that, in mm-hmm. doing community development stuff here on the North Side. Mm-hmm. So Dominic called me up, and he was able to convince Father Canise that... he couldn't do it by himself, mm-hmm. and that he needed somebody else. So he immediately kind of mm-hmm. got permission for that, and then asked me if I'd mm-hmm. take the job. So mm-hmm. I quit CCA and started working here. And as we kind of started to do our research, all in community development, and you know, what do we want to do? What do we accomplish here? One of the first things that we kind of was popping up was that the creative community idea. You know, that there that for post-industrial cities like this, there's kind of two ways of thinking about of revitalizing the city. One is saying, you know, we just got to bring, you know, like GM back, or we got to bring Carrier, you know, back around and get thousands of jobs and get big industry back in here. You know, and so that's the one thought that we just thought was a bit ludicrous and didn't seem to hold any water. And then the other idea of saying, well, you need to engage this new creative class of folks that's growing and that don't have a lot of money, like to spend the money that they do have, that are into moving into places that might not be the most picturesque right away, but they have faith in changing a community and improving it, and that they can bring in a lot of service jobs, so that they can bring in those jobs like, you know, a graphic design agency, or they can bring in jobs doing, you know, smaller stuff. They're never going to be major industries, but they're going to be restaurants. They're going to be clothing stores, boutiques. They're going to be, you know, like a printing company or whatever. So it's smaller scale stuff. But those are the folks that are going to be interested in moving to a place like Syracuse, because you can get cheap rent here. You can get a house that's not going to cost you a fortune. Plenty of storefronts that are open, and the cost of living just isn't that high here. So as we started researching kind of this idea of creative communities and class, and what brings people, you know, what's going to bring people to move into a community like the North Side, or to move up to Syracuse at all, we saw that, you know, in the literature, arts kept popping up. So if there's art venues, if there's ways for people to express themselves artistically, if there's public art on the street, you know, if there's just beautification projects happening, people are inclined to move to those areas because they can put in a bit of faith, okay, you know, I'm seeing this art pop up, I'm seeing that people are trying to beautify it, you know, I'm going to take a part of that and just be around it and be interested in it. So that was kind of my entrance from being just a viewer of public art to saying, well, how do we get public art to be on the North Side, or, you know, to be in Syracuse, to be on the North Side, to use it as a tool of bringing, to encouraging folks maybe to move here, to live here, to open a business here, whatever. I took more interest in that element of it, I guess, than Dominic did a little bit. I mean, he's very interested in it, but that kind of became a bit more of my focus. Simultaneously, he became heavily involved in the 40 Below group, and which now he's the board chair of it. So he became heavily invested in that, and I started to get a little bit involved. I was skeptical of the group as being just a group of yuppies that all drank together, kind of, you know, at happy hour, and
which they do get, have happy hours.
I don't think they I don't know if they still do that, but you know, and so I think I had that image because that's what it originally was. But there was a lot of folks in the leadership that said, you know, this isn't what we want to be about. We want to be about changing this community for the better, and so there started to be more folks like that popping up and starting to have faith in 40 Below as being kind of a potential change agent, and of, you know, the whole idea of the brain drain in upstate New York, like that we could actually retain folks from Syracuse University and from Lemoyne College, that they wouldn't all just move away as soon as they graduated. So 40 Below started the Public Arts Task Force, which Kate Clark headed up. And Kate kind of just became a friend of mine before I really knew her. I mean, I knew that that's what she was part of, but first we were just friends, and I was friends with her now fiancé, David Clayton, who's a sculptor. But the more we started talking, she the more that I kind of started volunteering my time toward the Public Arts Task Force in terms of helping set stuff up or, you know, showing up to events, supporting events, advertising, whatever it was. And then she kind of asked me to co-chair. Mm-hmm. So now I co-chair the Public Arts Task Force. And during that whole process, this is all kind of convoluted, I guess. But
no.
Is it all right?
Yeah, sure.
During that whole process, you know, Dominic and I here, because of our interest in arts and because I have a background in photography and he has a background in writing, we said, well, let's start doing, we need to get in the community and we got to meet folks and we need to just get a sense of what's going on, you know, and the model I learned at University of Maryland was you write up a 20-question survey, and you start knocking on doors, and you ask a bunch of questions. And that was the method I think Dominic had learned, too, in what he had done in Chicago. And we were both sick of it, and both didn't really believe that it was that effective. You know, you got a lot of doors slammed in your face. You got a lot of not constructive criticism, but just, you know, negative stuff that didn't really help. It was a very hiring process, and also knowing that most communities like this have people like us, you know, that come to the community and say, hey, fill out the survey, like, every 3 years, you know, maybe it's mm-hmm. a new white face that kind of shows up at their door and says, hey, I want to help your community, here's, you know, 20 questions I'm going to ask you, da da da. And we just didn't want to do that, so we said, well, what's a maybe more exciting way, a way we can use our gifts in a way that might just be more fun for us to do. So we thought of the idea of, how about I take photographs of folks and do kind of photo documentary